now using private email for government business, failing to keep minutes of ministerial meetings so there's no official record, sending confidential government documents to family members. Just some of the practices exposed by the RHI inquiry. Now, the leader of the TUV, Jim Allister, is trying to introduce legislation that would lead to jail term for politicians or officials found guilty of such behaviour in the future. I spoke to him earlier, along with the former MP Lambert Opic, and I asked Jim to outline his key points of this bill.
Well, it wants to tackle the multiple issues that were revealed. It wants, for example, to make sure that never again can someone with impunity leak out official information to their family. Never again can someone avoid scrutiny by failing to record their communications about government policy,
okay,
by simply using private emails, etc.
Let's look at those two first, Jim. Some will say...
Well, there's much more.
I understand, and we'll move on to them. We will. But why would you want them jailed, people that are found to be in breach of that, instead of, say, for example, giving them the sack, barring them from the profession and the embarrassment that would surround all of that?
Well, I think it's a bit misrepresenting to say I want them jailed. I believe that in order to create a real deterrent, you have to make those two things criminal offences, which will be the maximum deterrent for anyone in that position thinking, well, if I do use private emails when I should be using government emails, if I do leak material to my family when I shouldn't, then there are real consequences for that. If you put all those things in codes and put them into guidance, really, they don't have the bite that they need. And it's to give the deterrents bite.
And tell us more about that bite, Jim. That bite could be up to a 5-year jail term.
Well, if someone leaked for their advantage confidential material to give economic or financial advantage to family or friends or someone else, then that, in my book, is a serious matter. You know, we do have the Official Secrets Act. It has very trenchant penalties involved. I think that is proportionate. But like, all these things are for the detail of the bill. If it gets past second stage and goes through committee, and there are different views about all those tariffs levels, the appropriateness of this and the inappropriateness of something else, all that is in the mix. But I think the starting point is to say that those two deterrents in particular are vital to bring home to those who have been offending in this regard.
You mentioned the Official Secrets Act, for example, there, Jim. What about that and other legislation that's already in place? Is that not sufficient?
Well, I don't think it is, because I think the Official Secrets Act is really targeted more on big treasonable acts, as it were, you know, the top-end stuff. I think there is this gap at the more mundane level, which can be equally insidious, and that's what needs to be addressed. But I stress again, there's much more in this bill than that, including the huge squander we have on SPADs. You know, the Office of the First Deputy First Minister has the same number of SPADs as the entire Welsh government. They have 8 in Wales. We have 16 here, and 8 of them for the First and Deputy First Minister.
That's, and you want that 8 brought down to 4, is that right?
I want to bring that down to 4. I think that's a moderate, reasonable figure. I want to put some restraint on their salary. There have been SPADs being paid more than their ministers.
Okay.
There were SPADs being paid £92,000. I want the length.
Okay, we'll come into that.
To a civil servant grade, etc.
We'll come back to that in a moment, Jim.
I want to make them subject to the civil service disciplinary code, so they cannot do as they please.
Lambert O'Pick, what do you reckon?
I agree with the motives that Tim's putting forward, but I don't agree with the methods. And there's a simple reason. I was an MP for 13 years, and I saw all kinds of sharp practice which wriggled round regulations. The truth is, Jim and I will agree that what's happened is immoral. It just shouldn't have happened, but it did. And the people who did it would have known it was immoral. And that's the problem. Crime is already illegal. I think that there is enough restriction to stop law-abiding and moral people in politics from doing exactly the things that Jim is trying to stop without further legislation. And here's another problem. If you cannot send these documents, and they shouldn't have been sent, to family members and so on, it doesn't stop people secretly showing them in sharing them anyway without a paper trail. That's what happened. You know that, Tim. I know that. The endless leaking from government in Westminster happens whether or not it's allowed. My view is that what Jim's putting forward here isn't going to achieve that. It's virtue signalling in the sense that...
But surely it's not. It's the opposite. He's trying to say, this is exactly what will happen. This is the law, or would be. So therefore, there's no fluff about it or bluster. It's fact. And if you break the rules, this is what could happen to you. A maximum 5 years in jail.
It says that forcefully. And the active ingredient here is that criminalisation of the behaviour. But it's already wrong. There are already systems that could be used to give discretionary sentences, for example, by excluding someone from the political system, by getting somebody fired. All of that can happen now. It's just not being applied.
Yeah, but if they exist now, and I'm not debating with you whether they do or they don't, but you know, these things did happen in Stormont. There, you know, we found out through the inquiry what did happen in terms of information leak, the meetings, and the lack of minutes in some of them being kept. So you know, that's happening. And in terms of consequence, this is what Jim would say he's trying to rectify, yeah. Lambert.
Let's be blunt about it. I agree that the act, I think we said before, is to introduce these stiff criminal penalties. But I think that if what's happening at the moment happened under the existing codes, those criminal penalties will simply mean that people are even more careful to not be caught.
But I think Lambert's totally misguided in what he says, because, you know, he talks about what was done was immoral, but let's not have any law that prohibits it being done. You know, what we have isn't working. You know, let's take the issue of the discipline of SPADs. I want to put SPADs onto the disciplinary code of the civil service, and if they breach it, like any other civil service, they can be dealt with. So, yes, you know, it's not enough to simply say, oh, people would do it anyway. We have to have standards, we have to have them enforceable, and we have to put it up on the lights that these days are over.
Okay.
And that's what legislation does.
Let's go back to some other issues with SPADs. You mentioned earlier you want to cap pay, for example. You want to reduce the number in the executive office. When it comes to capping the pay, you refer to, I think, £92,000 as a salary for one particular SPAD, which
more
is...
more than one.
Well, that's a lot of money, is the point I'm trying to make. But also, surely you would agree, Jim, that if you're trying to attract the best people as a special advisor in government, you have got to go to people that would expect big money, that would be in maybe very high-powered, high-paid jobs to come and work for the government.
Sorry, are we attracting the best people, or are we...
Well, that's not for me to decide.
Are we attracting party functionaries? Are we rewarding people who've served the party for years? You just look down the list of previous SPADs and you'll not find too many of them who came there from outside interest.
We've had barristers, we've had very high-flying business people as well, Jim.
Most of them were party functionaries, but whatever their background, surely there has to be some level of moderation in the salary levels that are offered. If you have a situation where his SPAD has been paid more than his minister, where he can demand and get £92,000, surely it is right, since they are temporary civil servants with all the benefits of the civil service, that they should be linked to the civil service pay rates. And I suggest ranking them to grade 5 is generous.
And what's the top of that, Jim?
I think the top of that's around £75,000.
Mm-hmm. Lambert?
The problem, I used to be in human resources, and the problem here isn't the amount you pay, it's the incompetence of politicians in working out what you should pay. I've got some sympathy with what Jim's saying, but for a different reason. I have seen politicians pay ridiculous amounts for staff who could be bought for an awful lot less. But that's because we don't have any proper training of politicians when they decide what they pay their staff. Now, that's different. So I wouldn't be in favour of capping the amount, because it's just theoretically possible that you get an absolute genius who can, for example, kickstart the Northern Ireland economy or fix the health service there. But actually, much of the time, people just feel that they want to pay too much. There's an inherent tendency, which I've seen in all my life, in corporate life and in politics, where people want to pay too much for people that they like. I don't think that those caps are going to help with that. What we could have, which might be much more sensible, is an independent human resources facility in Stormont, where you actually have to go and get guidance before you sign off on payments, I think that would probably save hundreds of thousands, if not millions of pounds.
Okay.
That's different to actually having a cap.
Final question, Jim. What are the chances of this bill, in your opinion, actually making it through?
Well, I don't know. The critical first vote would come at the second stage, when the principles of the bill are voted on.
But you know a lot of people that are in government. I know we're just back, but you know who a lot of them are. What do you think they're going to... How are they going to feel about it?
Well, I suspect a lot of them won't want it. The question is, are they brazen enough to face down public opinion, which I believe does want it?
Okay.
Are they prepared to say, we're not going to put into law anything that requires us to change the way we've done things before, even though it was such a shambles, and we're going to pretend that we'll change it by good words and good deeds.
Okay.
But we're going to turn our back on the opportunity to make sure, to guarantee in legislation that things will change. There'll be a question for those parties whether they can rise above the vested interest and do it, but this bill will put it up to them.
All right.
And I think the public will expect them to live up to public expectations.
Jim Allister and Len Budopick, thank you both very much. On the line now, we have the political editor of the newsletter, Sam McBride. Good morning to you, Sam.
Good morning, Vinny.
So, after RHI, is the perception from Westminster of Stormont, is it that when the money is coming directly from London, we feel here it's open season?
Well, there's certainly huge scepticism from the Treasury and from Whitehall in general towards Stormont now. We've got Stormont ministers going to London, asking for more money, saying they've got a good case. And they are hamstrung, I think, in many cases by the sort of practices and behaviour which went on during the RHI scandal. I think on the Jim Allister's bill, it's for MLAs to decide whether this is is a proportionate response to the problem. But I think if we recap just slightly on what the problem is here, during the RHI inquiry, we've got evidence that Andrew Crawford, Arlene Foster's special advisor, paid by the public very handsomely, is passing confidential government information to his relatives. And that information makes clear that cash for ash is going to come to an end soon. They then install boilers. He says that they were going to do that anyway, and his information didn't have any impact there. That's for Judge Coughlin to rule on. We've then got a second example, which is actually equally concerning, I think, of Gareth Robinson, who is the son of the then First Minister, Peter Robinson. We are told by Andrew Crawford that he is passing to him, again, confidential government information, which it is clear is to his commercial advantage as a lobbyist, and that he is treating him preferentially because of who his father is. Now, I think it is clear that that is really difficult behaviour to justify, and there wasn't really any attempt at the inquiry to justify it by Andrew Crawford. And then we've got the third issue of this really massive use of private email accounts and other electronic systems, essentially either to hide information deliberately from the public and from civil servants and from other parties in the executive, or even if that is not the intent of what is happening, that is the effect of what is happening. And so you've got this massive problem that if Stormont is going to be reformed, there have to be changes here. And there's really nothing in last week's deal which seems to deal with these key issues. So if it's not going to be Jim Allister's bill, I think there is an onus on the executive now to come forward and say, how are we going to deal with these problems?
Yeah. And with that all in mind, going forward, do you think the threat of a potential jail sentence is something that is really needed in Stormont?
Well, I think it is clearly something which ups the ante very significantly. I mean, we've got talk of codes being updated. We've got talk of ministers being accountable for their special advisors. All of that in the deal is a start. It's moving Stormont away from a situation where people did not think they were accountable for their special advisors. But I think that it is questionable as to whether that in itself is enough. And I think there's another massive aspect of this. Using private email systems not only hides information from us, the public, and from other people within government, and that in itself is a dangerous principle of secrecy within government by people who are paid for by taxpayers. But I spoke to leading security expert, Professor Anthony Glees, and he was very clear that what was happening here was not only about secrecy, but one of the unintended consequences of that was that Stormont was leaving itself wide open to being hacked either by state interests in terms of some of the foreign trips where ministers were going to really make massive commercial decisions, or by commercial interests. These were people who were handling a budget of more than £10 billion. There was enormous There was very significant potential for people to want to know what was going on within Stormont, to get an advantage. And so this attempt, for whatever reason, to not use official systems was very, very serious. And I think there are a lot of people within Stormont who to this day don't really comprehend okay. how significant that was.
So just as we finish here, Sam, I then assume we should think going forward that the Treasury, Westminster, because of RHI, will be keeping a really close eye, a lot of scrutiny on Northern Ireland, on Stormont and the finances here.
They will, and I think that is very clear from the deal. It's slightly opaque still as to exactly how that will work itself out. But I think that okay. if we had even a change at the top of Stormont, it might be easier to make those arguments. With Arlene Foster, Michelle O'Neill, two people who were part of the last executive still there, much more difficult.
Okay, Sam McBride from the newsletter and other publications, I believe. Thank you very much. Sam was writing about that in the paper yesterday if you want to read more.